Welcome to That's a Wrap, episode number 7. Today we're talking about Star Trek, and we have Mark Clark, who is the author of the Star Trek FAQ 2.0, and we'll be talking to him just a little bit later. But real quick, let's just do a quick catch-up. Chris, you weren't here last week. What's up with you, man?
Enjoying wet, hot, rainy Florida. It's been pouring here for the past couple days, so in the middle of the rainy season. Other than that, doing well. Writing. Just got accepted to a conference in Savannah in October.
Well done.
So thank you. That's Pop Culture in the South, so I'm in the process of writing a paper on House of Cards and psychopaths. So
well, that goes together very nicely.
It does.
Sounds good.
It does. So having fun with that.
All right, great. Nick, anything?
Not much, man. Not since the last show. Writing and or trying to write, and that's about it, man. Just looking forward to talking with Mark tonight.
Yep, me too. I just wrapped up my spring semester at U of M Dearborn, mm-hmm. and had to submit grades today, as you know, and that was great. So I should be writing. Isn't that our mantra? So good news, we on the Facebook page, we have over 200 likes now.
Yes, well done. That's good news. Well done, us.
Woohoo!
That's
we're getting there.
Yeah, I don't know what the URL is for that, but if you go to thatsarapshow.com, you can find those. So that's good. On iTunes, we have 6 reviews so far. We're hoping that people will do some more reviews on there. We're hoping that that will get us a little higher in the rankings.
Absolutely.
On iTunes, so that's good news. And I don't know, everything's good.
Yeah, we have some very exciting shows coming up. I know that Dr. Robert Burgoyne is going to be joining us in August, so mm-hmm. that'll be fun. Bob is chair of the film department at St. Andrews in Scotland and a close friend of our very own Dr. Marshall's.
Yeah, and you just appeared on a video podcast, right? Oh, I think we talked about that in the last one, didn't we?
Yeah, we gave a shout out and some love to our buddies at the Cinephiles.
Yeah, that was awesome. I just watched that; it was great.
It was a lot of fun. So. Yeah, it was great fun. So
yeah, and today we have Mark Clark, who is our first person to be on twice, our first guest, right?
back to back,
in fact, talking about 60s horror last week, and now this week we'll be talking about Star Trek. So that's, I'm of course excited about that. And should we move right in?
I think so.
All right.
Sounds good to me.
Welcome to Principal Photography. Today we've got Mark Clark, author of the Star Trek FAQ 2.0.
And 1.0, yes.
And 1.0, and a couple other books as well, right?
Correct.
All right, great. So, so today I think primarily we'll be talking about Star Trek, and I think it's pretty wide open. We've got an interest. This should be pretty interesting, because I know Nick and I are huge Trekkers. I've been to a few conventions myself. I've got all kinds of, I probably shouldn't admit this, but
you nerd.
Got some memorabilia. The best memorabilia I have is when Voyager started back in, when was that, Mark? Voyager?
I didn't really write about that in the book.
95?
95.
Something like that. our local newspaper, the Detroit, it was the news of the Free Press, sent around this microwave popcorn that you could watch to like try to get you like, oh, watch Voyager with this microwave popcorn. And I still have that popcorn. I still have the... so stupid. what's that?
Mint and unpopped.
Mint and unpopped, you know. I think on eBay it goes for like $10 right now on eBay. So you
does
know,
the does the bag of popcorn actually have Voyager insignia on it?
The actual package does it?
Yeah.
I believe so. Yeah. Yeah. It says that's like "Join us for," and it's got the insignia. I don't have it here. If I did, I'd show you. But
Good piece of memorabilia there, Eric.
It is good.
Yeah, right. So anyway, so Nick and I are big Trekkers, but Chris, from what I understand, is not. So I think this would be a good conversation because it'll force us to have to get out of our geekdom a little bit and have to explain it to the to the uninitiated.
This is. I'm not asking you to justify it because I certainly respect it. But I am certainly, and I am a casual fan, but I have never been to a convention. I have no memorabilia, and I'm not even a Trekker, a Trekkie, a Trekkist. I'm not what you would consider that. So,
well, the interesting thing is that, well, at least I think it's interesting, maybe to somebody, would be that I'm really not either. I have yet to be to a Star Trek convention, although I may be appearing at some to promote the book, and not really somebody who necessarily thinks of myself as being a Trekker or a Trekkie or whatever you want to, whatever your preferred or not preferred term is. But it was a show that I always loved, and actually my wife is a huge Trek fan, and from her interest, in large part, we already owned like all the original series
and all of
Next Generation, and but not any memorabilia, that kind of thing. But when the opportunity came up to write these books, it gave me the chance to really study the series for the first time and learn about it in a deeper way. I mean, I had a good working knowledge of the show, as most people that are alive in the 20th century or 21st century, you know, have some knowledge of it. And I had seen all the episodes, so it was, and in the case of the original series, I'd seen them all many times, but it's just a whole different, you know, doing these two books really gave me a much more profound understanding and appreciation for both of those series and really the whole franchise. The books actually are intended for people who like the show, who love the show, maybe even, but aren't people who necessarily think of themselves as Trekkers or have a lot of memorabilia or have bought every book on the subject. They're sort of rounding up everything you might want to know about the show into one handy resource, and then also trying to find, especially in the case of the first book, trying to find new, fresh angles. Into it that haven't been where it has been approached before. It was a little bit harder to do that with the second book because the second book covers such a much larger scope. But the first book, especially, was a lot of opportunity to get into little nooks and crannies and things that had not really been dealt with before.
Yeah, that sounds good. I had a chance to look at it this afternoon, and I really liked it. I liked how you do, you know, there's kind of there's a background for particularly the movies, but also some of the other things, like the background, the reception, and then an assessment. And I like that formula because it like you said, I think it would help a lot of people who don't know much about Trek or just kind of interested in it. I think that was a really nice format and very, very readable, very readable, very interesting, I thought.
Chris, didn't you have a question?
I did. I guess as somebody who is, I guess, uninitiated, however you want to put it, the allure, I think, is the biggest thing that I'm fascinated about. And it's kind of funny how Star Trek fans have kind of been pigeonholed in this, like as these uber geeks, to the point where there was and Nick, you'll laugh at this, there was a character on the show, Frasier, and his, you know, this character, Noel Shemsky, who is this really geeky guy who never got the girls, and he obsessed about Star Trek to the point where he translates a speech into Klingon. He, you know,
it's the fastest growing language on the planet.
You know, so there's this kind of cultural stigma, if you want to assign it to Star Trek fans. That's I don't know if it's quite there with Star Wars fans, maybe almost. There's this allure that, again, me being a casual observer, and I appreciate it. I like sci-fi. It is not my favorite genre, but I like it. Maybe if you could explain a little bit to people like me, people who like the show, but don't really get, you know, what's with the conventions? What's with the memorabilia? Why are people walking around, you know, carrying tape? But spouting off in Klingon, carrying phasers, all that stuff.
Sure. Yeah, and it's ironic that you mentioned that Frasier episode because Kelsey Grammer is actually a huge Trekker and had done a guest appearance on Next Generation. And then later had both Patrick Stewart and Brent Spiner make appearances on his show.
They did. So, they did. I remember both of those episodes.
So it's just kind of ironic he would choose that as a subject for an episode. I'm sure that was with tongue in cheek. But this is actually the most common question I get in these interviews: is you know, what is it about Star Trek? What is the appeal of Star Trek? And I think it's a complicated answer, honestly. I mean, the basic thing I think that is appealing to people that are fans of the show is that, unlike a lot of science fiction, it offers a very upbeat picture of what the future can look like, and a very positive, affirming message about human nature and what people can be like. Somebody, and I forget who it was now, but in a book had written that Star Trek tells people that you're better than you think you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very it's easy to look around and see, God, the world sucks. You know, you just want to have something that's some kind of oasis of hope, and Star Trek is that for a lot of people. Fundamentally, and then there are other things too. I mean, there are with the original series. I mean, I think there was a unique chemistry between Shatner and Nimoy and DeForest Kelly in those three characters, in those three roles as Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And to a lesser extent, you get a lot of not the same kind of chemistry, but a lot of interesting performances and things from the Next Generation cast as well, with Patrick Stewart and Brent Spiner and Michael Dorn and all those guys. And I think it's the setting, that hopeful future, but also these characters that are people that fans just want to spend time with. You know, and that was the thing with the original series, like especially when the third season rolled around and some of the episodes kind of weren't the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
They were always fun to watch because they had those three guys in them, and they had this great rapport, and so that really continued to work even when the show wasn't really as good. And then with the Next Generation series, it took them a while to define those characters, but once they got on their feet, and the scripts improved, especially along about season three, you had that same dynamic, except it was actually more consistently well-written and produced the series than the original series was over a longer period of time.
Right.
You can't really beat the original series for about a season and a half, but the Next Generation did it for like about five seasons in a row.
Exactly, yeah.
So
I remember the end of that first season, end of the second season, Q Who was, I remember watching that. I had just taken my roommate Pedro to church. He didn't have a car, and came back home and watched that on Sunday, whatever time it was on what was it, UPN back then, right? So it's like Sunday at noon or something, and I think it was the last episode of that season, and just sat sort of like, I felt like Next Generation had really sort of taken off at that point, and had to wait, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was the last episode of that season.
I think the one you're thinking about actually is Best of Both Worlds, which was the end of season three.
Not that two-parter. No, when the Borg are very first introduced by Q.
Right. Yeah, that was in season three? Two, but it was season two, but it was not a cliffhanger. It was more toward the end of the season, but it was not
Borgs.
The
last. Okay.
The last episode of season two is a really terrible episode, actually.
Oh, is it? But it seemed to me like what you were just saying about establishing character, tone, direction with the show, a rapport between the actors on Next Generation, right around the time that Q Who came around, I remember thinking to myself that I had been really spellbound by that episode, and I thought, man, I think this show's really got a shot now.
Well, that was a great episode because it got Q in it, and it's got the Borg in it. It's the only time, one of the only times that ever happened. So you've got the two, it's kind of the two best things that ever happen on Next Generation happening at the same time in the same episode. So,
I wanted to ask you a question, Mark, and it's a basic one, but I think it's a good one in light of what you just sort of admitted to, which was you were a fan, but not like a huge, huge fan, and you knew all the series and the movies. But so my question is, like, what originally drew you to the project? And obviously, I know what drew you to the sequel, but I'm not exactly sure what drew you to the first project.
You know, honestly, what happened was our mutual friend David Hogan put me in contact with a guy named Robert Rodriguez, who had written a fantastic book called Fab Four FAQ about the Beatles. And had been the kickoff for this whole series of books from Backbeat, from Hal Leonard, which is Backbeat and Applause Books, and covering a wide range of music topics. They wanted to expand into film and television topics, and Rob was looking for somebody who would be good for that kind of a project. And they had a number of different titles that they wanted and properties they wanted covered. Mm-hmm. And so Rob contacted me, and we kicked around a bunch of different possible ideas. And one of the things near the top of the list was Star Trek, for, I mean, obvious reasons, for built-in, you know, readership. You can't do a whole lot better than Star Trek.
Right.
And it was one that appealed to me, number one, because I had grown up with the show. I loved the show. You know, we used to watch it, you know, in Louisville, Kentucky, where I grew up. It was always on Sundays at about 11:30, so I was camped out for the TV, you know, every Sunday morning. So there's a lot of connection on that level. But then also, you know, I just come out of writing the 60 Shockers book, which we talked about last week. And and I do want to thank It's a Wrap for being the official podcast home of Mark Clark. So
we're glad we could help.
Yeah. But it enabled me to kind of continue some of the threads from that book because, again, you had it was back to the 1960s and dealing with a lot of cultural change and a lot of things, you know, in terms of politics and, you know, civil rights and Vietnam were dealt with in coded ways, but in pretty blatantly, obviously coded ways in the original series. So the first book especially was a really natural continuation of a lot of the work and that I had been doing in the 60s book. And then, but when they wanted me to do Star Trek, I immediately said, well, you can't do Star Trek, you know, there's no way to do Star Trek in one book. You know, why don't we do a couple of books and let the first one just be about the original series, and then we can try to, you know, have the second one be mostly about the Next Generation, but kind of wrap, you know, do the best we can and wrap everything else up in that volume. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they went for that, and I had it was a two-book contract from the get-go, and so it was planned as a two-part, you know, as really, it's not so much a sequel as a companion volume.
Companion, for sure. Okay. Was there any initial, how should I phrase this, because I'm sure it would have happened to me, because Star Trek fans, Trekkers are so fiercely loyal and such a dedicated fan base. Was there any trepidation on your part, or did you just jump right in saying, I can't wait to dig into this?
Oh, I mean, I think you'd have to be, you know, brain damaged not to have some trepidation, because Star Trek fans can be very intense, and they're very loyal. They know everything. They're going to point out every little, like, well, you know, you had Janice Rand's cabin number wrong. And
is that a real example?
Well, no. But they're probably the really ridiculous ones if I thought about them. But, you know, I actually escaped without a lot of complaints about, you know, that kind of thing on at least the first book. You haven't seen a lot of, you know, the second book just came out. But I hope I did as well on the second book on that front. But
for an errata, yes.
But you know, there's that. And then, and just people want the, you know, they want Star Trek to be treated with respect. And they want, you know, frankly, they want Star Trek fans to be treated with respect. And one of the really cool things, I think, with the first book especially, I hate to keep going back to the first book, but this is where this is drifting tonight, but, you know, the first book is also kind of the story of the rise of Star Trek fandom. And there's a whole there's a whole section of the book that covers the years after the series was canceled up to the point right before they start making the first movie. And that's really when Star Trek becomes Star Trek. That's really when it emerges as a cultural force. When it was on the air, nobody paid a whole lot of attention to it. But when it came, you know, it didn't get, you know, the ratings were lousy and it didn't do anything for a lot of people. But when it finally got into syndication and was broadcast at a time that young people could see it, when they weren't out, you know, being young people on Friday, you know, night, it really took off, and the whole fandom phenomenon took off in a way that, you know, it was. Now you have, there are a lot of shows that have that kind of fan base and fan interactivity, but that was new then. It was revolutionary.
Sure.
Anyway, forget what the question was.
Oh no, it was just simply about trepidation, which you definitely answered, which was, of course, there was trepidation because of, you know, a rather ardent fan base is going to be quick to point out any errata that you know.
The other thing I found out about Star Trek is that, you know, while there certainly are some interesting people out there that are Star Trek fans and interesting in interesting ways. There are, there are a lot of great people that love Star Trek too, sure. And there are a lot of people that, like I said, don't necessarily think of themselves as Trekkers or anything, but are really deeply invested in the show, or who have, you know, decided they want to become a doctor because they like Dr. McCoy, or they wanted to be an engineer mm-hmm. because of Scotty, or pursued these, you know, had these really mm-hmm. productive careers because of the show. And the other thing, and there are also a lot of misnomers, especially in the beginning. When they were first, when I was talking about that era where you first started having conventions and Star mm-hmm. Trek fans really started to come together and form a network, the majority of Star Trek fans, and especially the majority of fans that wrote fan fiction, which was a whole other new phenomenon that nobody had ever heard of before, at least not to the degree that it became during that era. But anyway, mm-hmm. the majority of those fans at that time actually were women. If you see pictures from Star Trek conventions from the early 70s, it's all chicks.
There's I did not know that.
That's really unexpected.
Yeah.
And the fan fiction is written is probably, 70% female too. I mean, women were really invested in that series. And now that's not the stereotypical, depiction of Trekkers at all. And frankly, it's not the majority of Trekkers either. But there's still more female Star Trek fans than people think. Like my wife, for example. Yeah. And I know several other, as a result of writing this book, people come out of the woodwork, oh, you're writing about Star Trek. Oh, I love Star Trek. And a lot of those people have been, have been women, so.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, that is. I didn't know that either. Now it's the stereotype is a bunch of guys who would love to see a woman walk into the convention, right? The nerds. That's interesting. Do you have any reason why that is?
I don't know what happened in terms of that culture shift. I think initially, part of it may have been that, in those early days, especially if you read some of the, some of the fan fiction, it's like, a lot of it is women who want more footage of Leonard Nimoy with his shirt off, stuff like that. But over time, I really don't know why that shift occurred in terms of the fan base becoming more male and less female. And I think maybe it's just that that initial wave of fans just kind of, matured, went on, got into other things with their life because they were very young when it started, and then
right. The
second wave that came in behind them tended to be more kind of typical sci-fi fans as opposed to specific. I have no idea.
Nimoy had a really strong look in those early 70s. I got to tell you, he had those big ass thick sideburns and sort of that just sort of charming, Nimoy smile. And so when you look at the old footage of that, like that first New York con where they were so shocked that all these people had showed up, and I look at Nimoy and I'm like, Leonard looks pretty damn good there. He's got a leather jacket on, and those huge sideburns.
I actually had another question about the fandom aspect of it. What is the scope of Star Trek fandom across the world? Obviously, it's a phenomenon here in the States, but is it as big internationally as it is as things like Star Wars and other film franchises have been?
Well, there are always, as far back as that same era we're talking about from the early 70s, there have been international Star Trek fan clubs and things of that nature.
Right. Right.
And the series has done reasonably well. The TV shows have done reasonably well overseas. Now the movies, have not traditionally performed very well overseas at all. The Star Trek films have earned majority of their box office domestically, which is not typical for Hollywood science fiction movie.
Right, yeah.
Now, the exception to that has been the last two movies from J.J. Abrams, which have been great box office overseas. Yeah. But the previous ones, like, I believe, I want to say that the Star Trek V, the William Shatner one, was released directly to video in a lot of markets overseas.
Wow. I did not know that. That is shocking. I would have thought they would fare better. That's interesting. I'm wondering why they didn't do so well in other markets.
Well, especially when you look at other sci-fi films or fantasy sci-fi that haven't done well here, that have done well in Europe. Like the immediate one that comes to mind is Waterworld, which was such a bomb here, and it made all of its money back in Europe.
Or even just, I mean, how does one explain the universal connectivity to Star Wars, yet the fact that the Star Trek franchise seemed to limp by in other markets, as Mark was suggesting?
I'm trying to remember which movie it was that was out the same year as Aliens. I think it was
86.
It would have been maybe five. Star Trek. Was it five?
No. I think so.
No, that's too early. It must have been. I think it was four.
Yeah, I think it may have been four.
Is it The Voyage Home?
Home, I think, is 84, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah,
or
I think
is it 86? I don't know.
But where I'm going with this is that, and I think it was Star Trek IV, which did, you know, which until the first J.J. Abrams movie was the most highest grossing Star Trek movie.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But even that movie. If you compare that movie and Aliens, which came out the same year, the domestic box office receipts for those two films are very close. Mm-hmm. But overall, worldwide box office receipts, Alien crushes it because it just didn't sell many tickets overseas compared to what Aliens. Why that's the case. Now, I can make some guesses at why something like Star Wars might have more international appeal than Star Trek. I mean, in terms of, you know, Lucas designing something that's intentionally mythic and has all those elements to it that are designed to be universally translatable, where Star Trek was always kind of more of an American, Star Trek was really intended as sort of a vehicle for social commentary.
Yes, commentary and sort of like
I can see that.
Yeah, poster child for NASA and space exploration. Yep.
Yeah. So I mean, I think it's a little bit more kind of essentially domestic in its impulse than Star Wars is, where Star Wars is more universal in what it's trying to do.
Well, Eric, what was your take? It was always that Star Wars is Eric.
Yeah, I do want to talk about Star Wars versus Star Trek, or they're kind of the difference between the two at some point. We can do that now if you want. But, you know, to me, it's always Star Wars is fantasy and Star Trek is science fiction, right? Because Star Trek tries to posit a world that, you know, is in the future and it's based on technology and you can kind of extrapolate forward to that. But Star Wars is, you know, a long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, and it's more kind of magical and fantastical. Yeah, exactly, and I think that what Mark was saying is exactly right, because Lucas intentionally made it mythical, which is, you know, more universally kind of acceptable. But I think there's a huge difference between the two. People often put them in the same sentence: Star Wars, Star Trek. Oh, you're one of those guys. But right. I think there's, and of course, I like Star Wars, but there's a big difference between them. I think that utopianism or near utopianism of Star Trek, the social commentary is very different, and the outlook, I think, is very different. Yeah. And it had a message and a goal in the way that Star Wars doesn't. And you know, the appeal is different. I think Star Wars is meant to appeal to kids. I don't think Star Trek is at all. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that, but. Yeah, so different types of appeals definitely between the two. But every time someone calls Star Wars science fiction, I say, no. Star Trek is science fiction. Maybe I'm nitpicking, but I think it's a useful distinction to make.
No, I would definitely concur with the way the worlds were created by Lucas. It was and not just that, the way the story you know, it's people have called Star Wars very soap opera-ish, you know, and you get that that fantasy element and the combine the soap opera and the fantasy.
Well, I would say that Star Trek is a much larger world too. Yeah. Even though Star Wars is perceived as a very large world, I mean, you have six films and huge franchise. Star Trek is kind of blows it out of the water in the sense that you've got the original series, tremendous amount of TV iterations after that. I don't know how many films now. Let me see, like six and four and we have 12 now, I think.
12,
yeah. And I concur with Eric too. In fact, if you ask me right now if I had to swear allegiance to one universe or the other, I've been more of a Trekker my whole life than I love Star Wars. I'm one of those guys that saw the original three in the theater and loved them and bought the toys and had a great time with it. But something I guess it just appealed to me about Star Trek, the characters, I think somehow or another just spoke to me more, I guess. And I love the balance of characters, having Spock's emotional logic, you know, juxtapositioned against Kirk's fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants type of wonderful character foils, and then Bones trying to be the voice of reason between the two of them and provide comic relief. And I don't know, I guess I've always had more of an affection for Star Trek, and you know, but it seems like the world is geared more towards Star Wars, you know.
They're the lion, the tin man, and the scarecrow.
Nice.
Well, I think that there's also a certain, just speaking from somebody who who's a little younger, I didn't see I didn't see the first one in the theaters. I saw the third one, and I think that there's a lot of. And maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but there's a lot of nostalgia that's attached to Star Wars, and nostalgia's important.
Oh yeah, I mean it's Lucas's love of serials is basically the driving force behind it. You know, the old serials.
There's some nostalgia. I mean, certainly, audiences have nostalgia for Star Trek and Star Wars both, and I think that there's a certain amount of nostalgia behind the inspiration for both series. I mean. People think of Star Wars as being, very directly influenced by and inspired by serials, and certainly it was. But actually, so was Star Trek. One of the key influences that Roddenberry would cop to for Star Trek were things like Flash Gordon. Mm-hmm. That's not as immediately obviously apparent, but you have guys moving around. They have ray guns. They fight monsters. I mean, there's a lot of real space opera-y kind of stuff.
Sure.
On Star Trek, especially. The original series.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It probably would have been more successful in its initial iteration if there had been more of that, frankly.
Yes. Yeah. I agree.
You know, Mark, one of the things that really struck me about the book is now that I'm holding it in my hand here is the structure and approach. I love how it sort of got this sort of macro chronological aspect to it, but then within the actual structure of the book itself, you've got a season by season, show by show, movie by movie, and then you've got sort of this fascinating interplay in between chapters of character bios and actor bios and quotes and things like that, and the types of cuisine or I should say the wine. I mean, and the alcohol, the drinks of the Star Trek universe. It just struck me as such a great way to lay out the book, and I think fans will get a real big kick out of the approach that you've taken to laying it all out.
Well, I hope they do like it. One of the things is that that structure for the second book is completely different than the first book. So, I mean, the first book went over great, and it has a completely different structure. So I hope people like the way the second one is structured. It's more of a narrative. It is kind of designed that you can read, kind of pick up any chapter you want and read it without having to necessarily start at the beginning and read till the end. And the first book was more sort of to be consumed that way almost exclusively, whereas this book, and as a result, there was some repetition between chapters and things of that nature just by virtue of that format, Whereas this book does kind of have more of a narrative thrust that continues throughout the entire thing, but is interspersed with all the kind of content you're talking about, where you get backgrounds on some of the show's directors and guest stars and get into and delve into some of the other things that, like, there's a chapter on the fan made productions, which mm-hmm. was a lot of fun to write, mm-hmm. And just talk, you know, so I try to just mix in as much kind of off the wall stuff as I could, given that I had such a much larger scope to deal with this time around. This book's actually about 30 or 35,000 words longer than the first book, just because there's so much more.
Wow. Yeah, there's a lot more covered in this. That's a lot.
Well, the first book I was writing about essentially about 79 episodes. And, you know, there was a chapter about the cartoon, the Saturday morning cartoon show. Mm-hmm. This time I had to cover 11 movies and 276 episodes of Next Generation. And then they take a cursory look at three other entire TV series.
Yeah. Wow. That's a lot of material.
I look at my colleagues, Chris and Eric, and I actually look at them because their video's up right here in front of me, and I think, guys, you know, we've got some writing to do.
Yeah, no kidding.
We should do. You're making me feel like a slacker.
On the heels of his, of 60 Shockers, which had 600 films in it, over 600 films. So.
Yeah, and I didn't have Brian to be my lackey this time.
My favorite chapter title I saw this afternoon was Fistful of Datas. Yeah, something about the best of Brent Spiner or something like that. I thought that was a really clever chapter title. But what about what do you think about the new films? I feel like, I mean, there's so much to say about the Abrams films in comparison or contrast to the original Star Trek films and what they're doing with the universe. I have my own thoughts about it, but I was wondering if you have any thoughts about the direction Abrams is going.
Sure. I write about the first movie in the very last chapter of the latest book, and then I wrote a blog entry to cover the Into Darkness that ran on my publisher's website. But I mean, I think what Abrams did with those two movies was essentially what you had to do. I mean, some of it has to do with the state of the franchise and where it was when he stepped in and took it over. I mean, Nemesis had lost money, which had never happened with the Star Trek movie before. Enterprise had crashed and burned and got canceled before it completed its originally planned 7-season mission. Mm-hmm. So the franchise is really kind of in disarray and was becoming sort of very insular and inaccessible, and unless you were really a pretty hardcore trekker, it was very difficult to get into. I mean, there were not a lot of access points to it, because one of the things I write about in the book is that as they're building an audience through in the era of the movies and the Next Generation, it was great that all this stuff was interconnected and it gave you this whole huge canvas to paint on and just this whole landscape to dreamscape, mm-hmm. to fire up people's imaginations and all that, and it was very powerful. But then when things started to turn, when the shows didn't do as well, and when the movie started to really not be as bankable anymore, and when there was more competition from other series and other franchises, we had the X-Files and Babylon 5 and all these other things going on, and a different number of other movie franchises, mm-hmm. then the fact that it was also interrelated kind of made it, people kind of lumped everything together. So you'd have a bad movie or whatever, and people would kind of just think, well, the whole reputation of Star Trek started to kind of get downgraded a little bit, and mm-hmm. and the whole fan thing, where we were talking about earlier about that the cliche of the fan is the Star Trek fan as being this out of touch. Like in the Saturday Night Live skit, who's, people right. living in their parents' basements, and that
right.
sort of thing.
Right.
The Trekkies documentary.
Yeah, the whole franchise had kind of gotten stigmatized, and it had just gotten very insular and self-referential, and you had to get out of that. The only way to do that really was to just break it open. Mm-hmm. they had really had the continuity of that franchise had been like hermetically sealed and vacuum packed for 30 years.
Right.
You just had to crack that open and say, we're going to mess with this. So. and try to open it up and try to do something else with it. And he did that, and I think what he brought to it was this different sensibility, this more Star Wars-y sensibility, mm-hmm. that was more action-oriented, mm-hmm. that was more space opera-y, and, you know, but still had enough of the core Star Trek elements in it to work for most Star Trek fans, I mm-hmm. believe. Works for me, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. it just had a different MO to it and enabled them to just kind of break off. And it was interesting what they did, too, with the whole alternate, you know, reality kind of take on it, which is theoretically, you know, by doing what they've done, the old timeline with the old Kirk and everything yeah. else being all whatever, you know, peachy keen like it was before, for those people that liked it the way it was before, theoretically that timeline is still out there and they could
right.
still do more movies in that universe if they so desired. It was profitable for him to do that. I don't expect him to actually do that, but they could, theoretically.
Yeah, I like that approach, too, because people talk about how they just erased all that. I'm like, they didn't erase it. It's just an alternate timeline, right? So that timeline still exists. I hadn't thought about it in terms of making another other movies, but I think that's, I mean, it's, yeah, like you said, possible but not probable. But I like what they've done, too. I like what Abrams has done as well, for the most part. And in fact, now that you mention it, in the latest movie, the hokiest thing they do is when they go and talk to Leonard Nimoy, talk to Spock, right? Well, what happened when you ran into this guy? You know, I thought that was just a kind of gratuitous way to kind of nod to the original series fans. Oh, look, there's Leonard Nimoy. It didn't come off well at all to me, and I don't think they even have to do that. There's no reason for that. In my opinion, the movies stand, you know, pretty, I mean, I have problems with them, some problems, but they stand alone, they stand well on their own. I think it's a good, it's not a reboot, but it is a reboot, but it's, you know, it's an alternate universe. And I agree, it's fresh, it's new, you have young actors. What they've done with Spock is very interesting, I think, the character of Spock. I agree, like 86.5% with you.
I have to say, I think Marx is the most cogent, logical, and well-reasoned explanation I've ever heard about the reboot. As you guys know, I mean, I'm not a big fan. I didn't see the second film yet. I'm not a big fan of the first for reasons I don't have the time to get into. Suffice it to say, I think that, you know, and believe me, it's not built out of nostalgia, and it's not built out of a yearning for the past or anything like that. I just had a different sort of like view on how to reboot a franchise, rather than what Abrams did, which I understood from an economic standpoint beautifully, and from a creative standpoint, he wanted to essentially sever ties with the past and build off of the foundations of the show and take it in a new direction, just as Mark had explained. I have like, you know, well-reasoned arguments why I'm not a big fan of them, or Abrams in general, but it's we don't have the time to get into it. But I just have to interject very quickly here, though, that my dear friend in Traverse City, Michigan, Liz Ball, just commented, because she's listening, seriously geared more towards Star Trek. I'm not sure. She says she's not sure she can be friends with me anymore, because I had admitted I was more of a Star Trek guy than a Star Wars guy. This is true, Liz, and we can argue about this later.
It's interesting, though, kind of going back to that whole Star Wars thing, because you look at the reboot of the Star Wars franchise, you know, a few years ago, and all three films were, you know, they just weren't well received with hardcore fans. And now that the whole property of Star Wars has been bought by Disney, you have a lot more people who are rolling their eyes, thinking, "Oh, what the hell's going to come next?"
Well, yeah, with JJ, you know,
and
I think the next three with Disney and Abrams have to be better than the last three.
Well, that's,
nowhere to go but up. Yeah,
anything has to be than the last three, but it kind of does beg the question: what's the future of Star Trek? Where else do you think they're going to go?
For Star Trek?
Star Trek. Yeah. Like, what are they going to make more movies? Are they going to maybe boot into another series? What is the future of this interesting world?
Well, I'm positive there'll be more movies. I'm very curious to see how that's going to go and who they're going to bring, because I assume that Abrams won't be available to do it since he's going to be busy being Mr. Star Wars.
Oh, gee, that's
too bad. Right.
It's possible to get one of
the... Let me get... I need a Kleenex. Hold on a second.
It's possible that they'll get one of his, you know, cronies or something to do it, and he'll produce it, and so they'll have that kind of continuity involved with it. Or they could go, you know, I personally would kind of like to see him go in another direction, just to see how that would work out. Mm-hmm.
Kind of like when Alfonso Cuarón took over the third Harry Potter, right? It's a good analogy because, you know, he was the lone director of the series, right? I mean, there was one other one, but his own sensibilities were sort of, you know, artistic sensibilities were very much evident.
I would love to see him do it. And now that I've said this, I'm blanking on the guy's name, but the guy that did Skyfall.
Oh, sure.
Sam Mendes.
Sam Mendes.
Who I love, yeah.
In actual real movies. I mean, having shown that he could do like an action movie, it'd be really interesting to see somebody take a more mature kind of psychological approach with Star Trek that would still have, somebody could still do action stuff.
That would be very cool. Yeah, I agree with you, Mark. And there's rumblings that that Chris Nolan might take a stab at the next Bond film, too, which I thought would be very, very cool. But
that would be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think.
But going back to your other question, I mean, I'm sure there'll be more movies. I'm very curious to see if at some point they want to do another TV series, because I think to get this franchise really back where it was at its apex, which was like in that era where you were when they had, in the early '90s, we had things like the Undiscovered Country, the Star Trek VI, as well as the Next Generation going at the same time, and that's really when the franchise was generating the most money and was really the most exciting.
Really, yeah.
Biggest popular appeal is like it was the most sort of destigmatized it ever was during that era. It was like nobody was ever.
And maximum saturation, because then you had like Deep Space Nine and Voyager and.
Well, then they took it too far and but during
speaking
that,
of which, did you I wanted to ask you some questions about favorite. Like for example, do you have a favorite Star Trek film from, you know, the first series?
Of the original cast movies, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I like Wrath of Khan best.
Me too. But, yeah.
You can't really. That's hard to top. It's actually
hard to top.
Better. I think it's actually one of the best sci-fi action movies of the 80s. I mean,
yeah, without doubt.
You've got Aliens and you've got lots of other, you know, great movies, but I mean, I think if you've made a top 10, it'd have to be on the list somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. What about the? You know, I did read all of the your entries on the movies from both series, we are in like exact agreement on everything here, which we never are completely on anything. So it's like we're very close, but we always diverge somewhere along the path. And
I must be wrong about something.
Yeah. So we got to this point here, and I'm like, holy shit, Mark and I are in complete and utter agreement on this. And I really loved your assessment of Insurrection, which I felt was always kind of a slightly underrated film, and you pointed out a lot of things in there that I wasn't aware of, and particularly all the difficulties with the screenplay. I didn't know those existed, but your assessment that it was thematically quite sophisticated and kind of returned to Roddenberry's social commentary and stuff like that, and that it was probably best to play it low-key after the spectacular First Contact. Yeah, I thought there was really wonderful entry that you put together on that film.
Yeah, that's a movie that I do like. A lot of people don't. I do like it. It's got some problems. I mean,
sure.
Most Star Trek movies have problems of some sort or another, and to some extent or another. But I think it's a little underrated. It's better than a lot of people consider it. The main thing about that movie that, for me, that's a drawback is that every time I think about that movie, I think they could have done a Q movie instead. It wouldn't that have been cool?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And it would have been more successful too, I think. But for, you know, given what it is, I mean, it's got some lapses, but overall, I think it's pretty good.
I think it's one of those films. The Goldsmith score is particularly sort of like bucolic and lovely, you know, with the
village that Herman Zimmerman put together is an incredible accomplishment.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
Production design. And then it's got some of the comedy in it is actually pretty effective, and which is unusual.
Yes, not so heavy-handed, right.
It's got some very good sequences. it's pretty good. The Sona, the villains in that are really nasty too, which is helpful.
F. Murray's, it's like, you know, give that guy a chance to overact, and he always will, in a very good way. In a very good way, I think F. Murray Abraham's a scenery chomper in the sort of, like, you know, in the best tradition, though. I think he's great in that.
Yeah, he is a scene stealer, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, unless he's up against somebody of you know, equal or greater strength, and then which case, right. then it's really fascinating to watch the two of them, like the, you know, all the scenes in Amadeus, for example, or his,
right,
his scenes
with
Pacino in Scarface or whatever, right. what have you, you know.
You know, speaking of Six, you know, we were talking earlier, Nick and I, about the social messages of Star Trek and in a lot of the movies, and I think even the movies keep a lot of that social commentary, right? I mean, look at Four with Saving the Whales and all that. And I feel like with the Abrams movies, I know I keep harping on the Abrams movies, but I'm not sure the social commentary is still there, or if it is, it's different. And one thing I really noticed about these two movies, especially the last one, is that the Federation has become much more militaristic, mm-hmm. right? Whereas before it was about exploring, it seems now, I mean, at least some factions within the Federation are trying to make it more of a military kind of operation. And, you know, kind of stemming back to the destruction of Vulcan in the first one. And I'm wondering if that's, if, I mean, they must be trying to make some kind of parallels, of course, to perhaps terrorist attacks, you know, things like that, the world we live in now, which, I mean, if you read it like that, I think it's kind of hackneyed a little bit. But have they lost, like, with the Abrams and going the more, as you said, Star Wars direction? Are they losing the social commentary, or do you see some in those movies?
No, I think that part of the change in direction that Abrams made was to and probably the most radical one was to kind of step back from that a little bit. The movies aren't. His movies aren't as sort of overtly political or philosophical, in part because they're just, you know, everything happens, you know, everything's going by at 1,000 miles an hour.
Right. I know, that's what I hate about it sometimes. But I'm sorry, go on.
But, you know, so it's hard to, I mean, you can make a point at that speed, but it's difficult to make it to leave much of an impression when everything's happening that quickly. Now, but obviously it's attracting people. It's, you know, and they're still able to get. There's still, you know, that impulse that, like in the most recent movie, the idea that they're going to try to prevent the Federation from really becoming a very, you know, they turning into this really dark, really militaristic, kind of thing.
Really.
Basically, what they're fighting against in that movie. Not to give it away, Nick. Sorry, but
that's okay. Yeah, it doesn't. No, please go ahead, Mark.
You know, and that was honestly the kind of storyline that Roddenberry would never have approved in a million years during his lifetime. And they can. And but as soon as he was no longer really having sway over things, they immediately kind of took things in that direction. Berman and his, you know, and company kind of let it drift that way. Nemesis was more that way. A lot of the movies are more that way. I think if they ever do a TV show, you may get more of that political commentary, social commentary element coming out more strongly, because you only have, you know, you have to come up with a story exciting enough to carry, you know, the 2-hour movie and a whole, you know, especially young people's attention for that period of time. And right. and it's just hard to do that over the course of a movie. You know, although, I mean, I guess you could say that they did it, you know, with the original cast movies, and even some of the earlier, even with the Next Generation movies, mm-hmm. but they built those movies weren't built like these movies were. I mean, they didn't work like these movies, the Abrams movies work, and it's just harder to do it in that with that MO. In a TV series setting, you'd have more of an opportunity. We have more opportunities, period, to make some kind of a statement and different kind of stories that you could take in some of those
really
directions.
Spread your wings, yeah, over a course of a season.
So maybe Al Gore needs to direct the TV series.
I don't think the social commentary element's missing from the Abrams movies, but I think it's greatly de-emphasized. Yeah. I think his approach is much more George Lucas than Gene Roddenberry. I mean, Gene Roddenberry really, as I mentioned earlier, really saw that whole idea of, you know, he created Star Trek because he wanted to be able to talk about social issues on television, and his first attempt to do that with his TV series The Lieutenant didn't work out because this network would let him say, and then he's also had to get the Marine Corps seal of approval because it was shot at Camp Pendleton in California. So he just wasn't able to say or the things he make the statements he wanted to make. So he decided if he can't make the same statements, if he just moved everything to outer space and put people in, you know, green body makeup and stuff, and he could do it, and it worked. But that was that impulse that I'm making this show or this movie because I have this thing I want to say. I don't get the impression that's really what's driving J.J. Abrams.
No, I agree.
He's very much a gun for hire.
Yeah. You guys familiar with the Honest Trailers? That's on YouTube. They do this it's Honest Trailers, like what the movie's really about, sort of thing. There's one about Star Trek, the first movie.
Yeah.
And part of the trailer, I'll post it on the show notes. But they talk about it being Abrams' Star Wars reel, you know, Star Wars audition reel. Oh. And they put side by side scenes from the first Abrams Star Trek movie with scenes from Star Wars, and they're exact. It's really weird.
Really?
So yeah, it's really great. I meant to show it to you guys earlier,
Yeah, the new movie has a pretty much direct lift from Empire Strikes Back in it.
I just have to spit this out, you know, before the podcast, you know, is finished tonight, and that is with Star Trek II being my favorite film. I mean, I have very fond memories of my mom taking me to that here in Southfield, Michigan, in 1982, and thinking, you know, what the hell? How can Spock die? What's going on here? You know, it's very, very good stuff. But with that being said, in the Abrams reboot, when I saw them resurrect the Kobayashi Maru, I thought, this is fantastic. I love this little thread of continuity here that they're dangling in front of me like a fetid, rotted carrot, because that's what it turned out to be. I thought their sort of like revisionist attitude towards the Kobayashi Maru really upset me. It becomes this major early sort of like antagonistic moment, the catalyst, if you will, to set up some animus between Spock and Kirk, which, you know, is also kind of new as well. And then he's, you know, he talks about how he gets a medal for, you know, commendation for original thinking in Star Trek II, and then in this version, he's on trial, and then they just let it sit the rest of the film. It's never even addressed again. And I thought sloppy screenwriting and almost offensive to some degree to, like, bring something that's treasured and then kind of piss all over it. Really upset me. I took it like personally, you know.
Well, you probably don't want to see the new movie then, because
exactly.
Because everything Mark has said tonight about like the Abrams film, I totally agree with, and it makes perfect sense. But there's no reason really to like drop trial and urinate over the Kobayashi Maru, which was like, let's make this a big deal and then drop it and never talk about it again the rest of the film.
And
leave it unresolved.
Well, I don't know. I misremembered, but I thought they had resolved that at the, you know, they do the whole thing at the end where it's like, you know, we forgive you for your previous sins because you just saved the universe kind of thing. But
that's in every film. It's like, okay, yeah. Kirk, we forgive you. We'll demote you and give you back your ship. Or okay, Kirk, this. Or okay, Kirk.
Well, we've seen it before, but I think that's what happens at the end of that movie. But the most recent one is very interesting. And while it would probably make you have an aneurysm based on what you've just said,
it's really interesting because it takes
Wrath of Khan and uses it to sort of toy with audience expectations. It sets things up, introduces scenarios that are going to be very familiar to anybody that's seen that movie, but then spins them in a way you don't, in a different way, and sort of screws with your head based on what they assume you're going to assume based on what you already know about the movie you've already seen, which is I think a very clever to play it.
Clever.
Sort of pissing on it, but you know that's. I thought
I mean, if you look at reboots, say like Casino Royale, which seemed to be very reverent to Bond. I mean, it's resurrecting his first case. You know, it seemed to be very reverent to the source material and not create some sort of alternate universe where they can say, that all of these this 50 years of memories, you know, may or may not have happened, seems to be like a real cheat to me. I said I wasn't going to do this, but here I am doing it. Is that I think Abrams' hubris here? I mean, he really did sort of Icarus this. I thought he flew very close to the sun, and for a lot of people, including myself, I think burned himself because, you know, he's admitted to being sort of like not much of a Star Trek fan, and perhaps it's his fresh eyes that would exactly invigorate into the series that injection of outsider's potential, maybe, you know, and a unique set of eyes. But I think that's exactly what it had the opposite effect to me. It seemed to be a very convoluted plot to say, I want to reboot this. And I thought, well, you know, look at Casino Royale as a very effective reboot without actually having to, again, drop trial and urinate on 50 years of Bond history.
Well, but Casino, you know, how do I want to put this? You know, there are a lot of big James Bond fans out there, including me. But I don't know that people are, you know, the Bond films really in general have never had the kind of internal continuity and people really obsessing over those kind of little details. We had, you know, a different Felix Leiter in every movie.
Sure.
So it was, you know, it was different. And, you know, based on the reality of how fans would react to just kind of saying, well, we're just starting over, and we're going to do, you know, I'm not sure that approach would have worked with Star Trek. I mean, they had to come up with something, mm-hmm. and if they had gone back to the beginning and just said, well, we're just going to tell these early stories of Kirk and Spock, but we're not going to change the characters at all, we're not going to change anything else about it, then you run into the trap that they ran into with Enterprise, mm-hmm. which is that people already know how story ends. Mm-hmm. They know. You know, you can work in clever little references that are very sort of inside baseball to people that are big fans of the franchise that they'll appreciate, and they actually do a lot of that in the movies anyway, and in the Abrams movies. But you know, but it's not the same thing. I mean, I really think they had to just do something. The two choices really available to them were do what they did essentially, mm-hmm. or like jump forward 100 years and do something that would be a totally different. Cast of characters in a totally different setting, but still, you know, like they did with Next Generation. But right. obvious marketing.
Mark, I agree with you 100% there. I just, in my estimation, it could have used a lighter touch, is what I'm saying. Is that I think Abrams, yeah, I think he was a bull in a china cabinet on the first Star Trek.
Yeah, I'm not the world's biggest fan of Abrams or those two movies. I like both of those movies. I like Into Darkness better than I liked the 2009 film. You know, it basically has you know, all the same problems that the first one had, but they're not quite as bad this time around. And then the good stuff in Into Darkness is a lot better than the good stuff in the 2009 movie is the main benefit it has.
Well, that's good. I mean, I'm looking forward to watching them. And
yeah,
and,
I agree. You know. Yeah, I agree with what Mark just said. I do feel like the references to Khan, I feel like as an outsider, Abrams was like, oh, people seem to like the Star Trek 2. Let's put this Khan guy in there. And, I mean, the movie...
Cumberthwaite dude is supposed to be Khan?
Yeah. Okay. And sorry for the spoilers, but, you know, the thing's been out a month, right? So, what was I saying? I feel like the movie could have played exactly the same, but his name could have been like Chad Jones or something, because it didn't have to be Khan except for the reference back to the second movie and the kind of reversal. This I won't give away, but there's a little reversal at the end, which is kind of predictable, but
this
it's
is you know. City Alpha.
So, Chris, you had another question?
Yeah, my last question, I guess, would be for somebody who is. You know, likes it, but all those, especially those who are listening, who are also similarly uninitiated and maybe really weren't huge fans. What is a good entry point? You know, we've talked about the movies, we've talked about the television shows. What's a good entry point to kind of initiate yourself into this universe? Is it to go all the way back to the original series, watch the original series, watch the movies, watch The Next Generation, watch Voyager?
Yeah, I think we probably all have an answer to that.
So, and that's kind of why I was throwing it out there. for people who are listening to this and thinking, wow, this sounds really interesting. I've watched it casually, and I like Star Wars, and you know, I want to get into Star Trek. Where would somebody start? Almost like a verbal wiki, if you guys will.
Mark?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I would tend to think, I mean, for one, if that's kind of, although it is kind of a weird question, because it's hard for me to imagine that there's anybody out there that hasn't already seen some Star Trek, but I guess it's possible. if it depends kind of on your sensibility. If you want to go back to the basics, I mean, you really can't go wrong with watching them with starting out with the first two seasons of the original series.
Well, especially if I can interrupt just one quick question, I'm sorry. The main reason I asked that is because there is this phenomenon now of binge watching, mm-hmm. where when people hear about a series, they say, "I want to watch the whole thing," and they go back all the way to the beginning.
I'm so doing you're that getting with that, damages right now.
You're getting
Fringe.
That. You're getting that with a lot of shows where people say, "Oh wow, I heard about Mad Men. Well, I don't want to just jump in now. I want to start all the way at the beginning, and I want to watch the entire thing."
Right.
You know, and they binge watch. So mm-hmm. that's part of the impetus as to why I was asking the question. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but I did want to kind of clarify where that was coming from.
Well, if you want to go on a binge. I mean, original series, there's only 79 episodes, so it's not that epic a binge to go on. Mm-hmm. And especially if you watch the first couple of seasons, if you're into the whole kitschy 60s, you know, miniskirts and go-go boots scene, you know, right up your alley too. So there's that. And then in terms of next gen, season, you know, 3, 4, 5, that's kind of the sweet spot, even into season 6, but really those seasons are kind of the prime of that show. And then in terms of movies, you know, we talked about the Rathcon, the sixth movie, The Undiscovered Country, I think is really good and a little bit maybe underrated. The fourth one, the one with the whales, of course, that most people have seen.
The whales, I like that.
Well, and that's the one that's like, you know, people would come up to Harv Bennett on the street apparently and tell him, you know, I don't really like Star Trek, but I like the one with the whale.
Yeah, it's the most accessible mainstream entry. I think the humor was a new element too.
It's kind of the Star Trek movie for people that don't really like Star Trek that much because it's
exactly.
funny, you know, whatever. And then the First Contact, which is a movie I liked a lot seeing it again recently. Is kind of probably is easily the best of the Next Generation movies if you really want to watch a Next Gen movie.
So tight.
Yeah, but yeah, I would think the first couple seasons of the original series, or you know, seasons 3, 4, 5 of if you don't like that, you're not going to like Star Trek. I mean, that's as good.
I'd echo what Mark says. Yeah, I'm sorry, Mark. Did you say something?
I was going to say, and then there are the other series we haven't even talked about. I mean, Deep Space Nine, I think was not an ideal show, but it was a very well written show, and you know, there's other stuff out there. But I think in terms of primo stuff, those would be the ones of original series and Next Gen.
My take would be the same. I would say that you don't have to sort of, like as Mark said, start anywhere in particular chronologically speaking. But if I were to give advice to somebody, I would say to go back to the original series because it lays the foundation for everything. You will more richly enjoy the other series with that base knowledge of the first series, and it is, you know, wonderfully it's a great time capsule to go back and look at those films too, and look at the sort of cutting edge of what was acceptable on television at the time. Look at Roddenberry's rather explicit heavy-handed attempts at social commentary, but you have to look at them in the context. They're heavy-handed, you know, through a lens that we look at today, but back then, to see that on television taboos addressed in society through the veil of allegory of science fiction was, still pretty much in its infancy, apart from, like, Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, so it was getting away with a lot of stuff that was quite cutting edge back then, and it's lovely to watch. I'm a big fan of the original series and have very fond memories of them.
The one thing I would just reinforce that by just citing the example of, you know, Star Trek was it's one of or you know one of the first shows to feature, a kiss between, you know, an interracial kiss.
Interracial
when
kiss.
When that series debuted, it debuted in 1966, was a year before the Loving versus Virginia decision that struck down anti-miscegenation laws across the country. So the time the show debuted, it was still illegal in many states for black people and white people to marry. So, I mean, just to give you an idea of how, you know, edgy the show was, it seems tame now, but at the time it was pretty out there. The only other thing I wanted to say, Nick, was I think it's great to go back to the original series. I love the original series. It is the basis for everything else. But the Next Generation has enough of an identity of its own that you don't have to do that. I mean, I think if the special, the cheese, you know, kind of special effects and other problems with the, and you know, that are hard to look at now if you're, you know, from a different, although, you know, Next Generation now is getting a little long in the tooth too, but but things look a little bit better than they do on a kind of basic level if you're just compared to what you're used to seeing on television.
Sure. I'd agree with that. I think
you can also do Next Gen first.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of Star Trek fans like my wife who really discovered the Star Trek and got into it with the Next Generation and only later went back and watched the original series and they're very devoted to the whole franchise, but you know, especially the Next Generation.
Sometimes so. I think allegiances are struck depending on what you saw first, and I think that's just innate in human nature. Sometimes that when you saw something first, you tend to you hear a song that was originally written by this person, but you've heard it performed by this band your whole life, and you prefer that because that's what you heard first, for example. And yeah, I'd agree with you on there, Mark. It certainly does have its own identity, and certainly much larger and longer run. And very, very full characters. So it stands alone on its own. I'd say that it would be a heightened appreciation of the universe is probably there if you know the original series, though. But if you don't, it's no hindrance.
You know, for me, you know, the original series was what I grew up with and has a you know, there's a place in my heart for that series that is just different than for, you know, like that show and Kolchak the Night Stalker. TV heart, you know. Mm-hmm. But in a way that no other show is going to. But having, you know, looked very closely and studied and everything else, all the episodes of both of those series, and frankly, having seen all the episodes of all the other series too, I actually think that sort of in the main, Next Generation is the best Star Trek series.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you too. I no question on my part. It's the one, and oddly enough, it's the one I think that was viewed, obviously, since it was the first one, right? The first sort of reincarnation of the original series. What can we do with it? It was the one eyed with the most sort of squinty eyes and skepticism by the public. Everybody was excited for it, but we were like, oh, man, Picard's no Kirk. And this went on for quite a while until eventually it started to win over a very loyal and dedicated fan base. And it is, I think, the best series. I agree with you. My sentimental favorite is going to be the first, simply because I think, as I was arguing earlier, it's kind of like it's the first, you know, it's wrapped up in my childhood, sitting there eating spaghetti, leftover spaghetti, and watching it with my brother, and, you know, all those very famous episodes. And Kirk's so badass, too. You know, you just got to love Kirk and Spock. And but they have very successful counterpoints on In Generations. And one of my absolute all-time favorite episodes of any Star Trek, you know, it's in the top three, is, oh shit, what's the name of it? The one where Q takes Picard back to that, to his, where he has the, he gets the fake heart put in.
Tapestry,
thank
Great
you.
Great episode.
Yeah. Tapestry is probably in my top three Star Trek episodes of all time, you know, across all 27 series. So well done.
Well, I think, I know Chris has to go, we should probably wrap this up. We're at about an hour and 10 minutes.
Okay.
So so thanks for joining us, Mark.
Anytime.
You can, Mark Clark, your book is, the books we're talking about are Star Trek FAQ 1.0, FAQ 1.0, and Star Trek FAQ FAQ 2.0. I always say FAQ. I've been told to say FAQ. Yes. So, you know, I guess we'll have you on next week for another book or... No, but you can get the books. I know you can get them on Amazon. I'm sure you can visit the publisher's site. We'll link to the blog entry you talked about, where you write about the Into Darkness. Mm-hmm. We'll put a link on the show page, as well as some other stuff. But yeah, this is a great conversation.
Absolutely wonderful conversation. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Happy to be here. Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper, buddy. Okay.
Cut. That's a wrap.